So the hard part is it takes a lot of planning. It
Yeah.
takes a lot of communication and organization. It's possible, but at the same time, like the reality is your time's split, right? And you have to manage around that.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace, where we discuss real-time workplace issues with experts to get you the best solutions for your company. I'm your host, Carol Schultz, organizational strategist and creator of the Organizational Scaffold System. Let's get into it.
Welcome back to Evolving Your Workplace. I'm your host, Carol Schultz. Quick reminder, we like to keep these conversations as authentic as possible, so we leave in the best parts and the mistakes. My guest today is a highly successful CEO, but in a unique situation. He splits his time between two companies under one umbrella. He's Greg Moore, founder and CEO of Fit3D, the world's leading 3D body scanning company, and Wear, a virtual fitting room technology. Greg, thanks for joining us today. Can you tell us a little bit about your umbrella of companies first?
Yeah. Carol, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it. I'm super excited. I guess I'll give you a background story. That's probably the best way to describe the two companies. But we actually set out on a mission in 2012 to be the world's authority in body data. Until we realized is that nobody had ever captured body measurement data from across the globe. It was like this data set that just didn't exist. And so we started Fit3D, which is the umbrella company and the body scanning brand side of the business, to basically deploy these body scanners all over the world to capture demographic worth of body measurements. And then the concept was to build businesses off the top of that data. And that's where Wear comes in. Mm-hmm. So Wear took all that body data, and I think there's like almost 6 million human body scans now on the platform. It built a prediction model on top of it where we could predict people's body dimensions. And then we launched that to apparel e-commerce companies. And so let's say you're shopping for a shirt or some jeans or something, and you don't know your size. You'll click on the little button that says, what's my fit? Or what's my size? It'll launch us up. We'll ask a few questions. We predict all of your body dimensions and then recommend you the best fitting size. And then we take that data on the backside, feed it to the brand so they could make better marketing, design, inventory management, and merchandising decisions. Mm-hmm. So these two businesses sit under one corporate umbrella, Fit3D Incorporated, but they're operated as two totally different business segments, which is quite taxing.
Mm-hmm. Got it. So here's the million, or may I say multi-million dollar question. As someone who leads both companies, do you feel as though it's possible to spend your time, to split your time without either of your teams feeling a battle for your attention?
Yeah. I mean, it's like, you know, when you have your first kid, right? You put all of your time, your energy into that one kid, and then all of a sudden the second kid comes up and you're trying to convince yourself that there's enough of you to go around, but there's not. You just learn how to adapt. And so in that sense, I think that both companies have adapted to my time. We understand that I'm going to have projects that are going to pull me on and off. And then for me, the edit my best is when I figure out how to create a system where I'm not the linchpin, right? Mm-hmm. And in order to do that, the companies need to be relatively capitally flush. So if I'm actually taking on IC roles, like individual contributor roles, like I am right now, like for where I am the sales guy, then I have to make sure that I adhere to those responsibilities, but then portion my time and make sure my team understands my time such that they know that they can reach me for the other company like during these specific blocks of time. And so they can save their questions so I don't have to context switch all day. So the hard part is it takes a lot of planning.
Yeah.
It takes a lot of communication and organization. It's possible, but at the same time, like the reality is your time's split, right? And you have to manage around that.
Right. So you mentioned that, you know, you are the sales guy and you said that was for where? Mm-hmm. Why are you the CEO, the sales guy?
Small company, right? I mean, I think we're in the seven figures, but we're not high in the seven figures. Okay. And so as you're building it, there's this concept of founder-led sales. And when you are pretty early in the company's life cycle, like we're a couple of years old, you know, again, we've reached seven figures, which is great, but like we're still growing and it still requires this like really complex understanding of every piece of the business to get a sale organized, right? To get the sale through the go-to-market motion. And we've tried other salespeople. To be honest with you, I've probably hired six other salespeople for Wear, and some of them are really good. they're very, very successful at other things. But what we do is a very complicated science that needs to be communicated in a non-complicated manner to people that are really good at tuning e-commerce engines. That's not an easy task to do. And so I think like when you're at the point where you can bring on salespeople is when you're at the point where you have a repeatable sales motion. Mm-hmm. And we're just not there yet with Ware, right? Fit3D, all day long. I have nothing to do with sales, pure strategy on that side. But for Ware, we haven't developed that muscle yet to be able to have this like repeatable sales motion that I can then hand off. So I'm still tuning it based on every opportunity that comes through.
So what's the challenge?
We're ready to hit that transition point.
Yeah. What do you think the challenge is with that?
Yeah. And it's a good question. There's like the flippy answer, right? And then there's the deep answer. I think the deep answer is that we are not the innovator. We have innovated how we do it, but we're not the incumbent, right? So the people that invented our solution in the space have been around for 12 to 15 years. Mm-hmm. My personal opinion is they did kind of a really crappy job at it, but they did it enough to convince a market that the solution is good. Now the solution, they're churning all their customers. Mm-hmm. We came into this market doing it a different way. We're like, all right, we took a look at that. They sort of solved the problem a little bit, but they could go a lot further. And we feel like we have the secret sauce to get us like the next level. Mm-hmm. So what happens is that we then have to convince these people that may have tried another solution that ours, which looks very similar on the surface, is extremely different on the backside, which it is. But we have to convince them, and then they have to trust us. And that trust takes a lot of time to build. And it's a really critical moment for our customers, right? Mm-hmm. Because that size selection block is the critical moment when the shopper either converts or they don't. And it is responsible for like 35% abandonment rate, 50% of all returns, right? So the stakes are really high. Mm-hmm. And so when we come in, we're like, hey, here's what we do. Here's how we've done it with other customers. We have proof points. You can talk to them if you want to. There's still this level of trust that needs to happen. And I think that trust is kind of hard to come by when they've been burned a time or two in the industry. That's the nitty answer, right? That's the gritty answer on the backside.
Yeah. So walk us through what the downsides may be of splitting your time between two companies, even though they're under the same umbrella.
Yeah. I mean, I think like if I were to do it all over again, I wouldn't. That's the first thing.
Note, founders listening to this.
Yeah, right. I mean, I honestly like, I love being a founder. I will always be an entrepreneur.
Yeah.
I've been an entrepreneur in other companies. I will always be an entrepreneur, right? So it's not that I wouldn't start a company again. Mm-hmm. It's that I wouldn't start two at the same time. I think that unless I could ensure that they were appropriately capitalized. Mm-hmm. Because if you can act more like a holdings company, right? Or like an investor with a small portfolio, and you can strategically distribute your time, great, right? Because you can take things that worked in this company, build these like synergistic mm-hmm. layers, and then operate them or like suggest them on this other company. Perfect way to do it. But again, if you're the linchpin, if you are in the moment arm of the operations, like that's where it gets really hard, because you know that if you dedicated 100% of your time to one of the companies, it would flourish.
Yeah.
And the challenge that we run into is that these companies are symbiotic. Like they only exist because the other exists. Any one of them doesn't make enough to exist on their own. And so we literally cannot separate them and run them as two separate entities because of the finances associated with the company, right? They've got big, but they're not big enough to be standalone. And so that I think is one of the biggest challenges. So again, going back to it, If you can capitalize it effectively, mm-hmm. if you can get yourself out of an individual contributor role, and if you can ensure that you are not the linchpin for success and growth, mm-hmm. then running multiple companies is fine. But if any of those three tests fail, then I think it's going to be a heavy challenge to grow both companies adequately.
I have to imagine that this thought has occurred to you, and I'm curious as to, you know, where you've gone with that. You know, you say they're not really big enough to exist on their own. Well, why not? I mean, forget about the umbrella. Why not just combine the companies into one?
I mean, they effectively
with then two products.
Yeah. They effectively are combined, right? It's one P&L. For those of you who use QuickBooks, it's split by classes so we can keep track of both independently, but it's all together. The challenge is that the technical stack is the same. The operating stack is the same, but who we sell to is entirely different. Right. So from your sales, your marketing, and your operations models, mm-hmm. those are two totally separate teams.
Right.
There's zero synergies between the two of them. Mm-hmm. And so in that sense, you know, we've combined everything we can combine. Finance, technology, product to a sense, all that's combined. But mm-hmm. then there's still the, how do you operate the business, right? Mm-hmm. Assuming that those things are fixed. Those are unique. They're independent. And so because we sell to two totally different markets, you're going to have two separate teams, right? It's just, it's a totally different sense. Mm-hmm.
So when we first talked, and you mentioned this in passing here just now about what often leads to cart abandonment, right? Mm-hmm. And I had told you a story of a dress that I bought that I found online. It might have been an ad on Facebook, and shame on me. I should have known better. But, you know, fool me once, right?
Yep.
It was gorgeous. And the first thing I did was go to the website, and it was a New York company. So I thought, okay, this has got to be the real deal. Well,
yeah.
And I bought it because I screenshotted the, you know, 100% no ask money back guarantee. And I went ahead and bought it, and the fabric was completely crap, and it fit part of me, but not, you know, the top didn't fit me. I just, you know, couldn't squeeze my boobs into it. And, you know, and I immediately told them this is the problem with it. You know, let me know where I can send it back to. And they said, no, just keep it. We'll just refund you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I mentioned this to a friend also, and they said, yeah, I don't understand these companies. They just keep it. Like, what's, are they just not losing that much money that they can afford to take those losses? I mean, it seems like what you're selling would be such a better solution to having this problem.
It is a better solution, but companies have just done it this way for so long. To change it everyone is afraid of change, right? Everyone's afraid of innovation, in a sense. Everyone wants to be second to the party, not the first. Mm-hmm. But I think, yeah, it's interesting, right? Like Amazon came on and they sort of created this free return policy. Before that, I don't know if you remember, but like you had to pay for returns. You had to physically pay to ship them back to the company. They would assess them, and right. then they would determine whether or not they would refund it or exchange it or simply just keep your money because there was a little stain on it, right?
Yeah.
It was not transparent. Uh-huh. Amazon came on, and one of the things that I think is not spoken about enough, but their return policy is one of the things that made them successful, right? And they just said, like, free returns, we'll take care of it, you don't worry about it. And they forced these operating models onto all of their
sellers,
sellers. And now that there's a decade plus of returns data, what these brands are realizing is that for certain items, it is far less expensive for them to allow you to keep it than to pay for the shipping label, mm-hmm. and then to pay for a human to go inspect
right,
it,
right.
and then to pay for a human to go restock it. Mm. And then to likely sell it at a secondhand opportunity on their online store, or maybe it goes to like a Nordstrom Rack, or maybe it goes to a Marshalls or whatever, mm-hmm. in a secondhand thing as a wholesale opportunity. So mm-hmm. when they do the monetary, like
the math on that, sure.
I was like, it's just easier to let you keep it. And so now, and I don't know if this happened to you, but it happened to me. I did the same thing knowing what I know, right?
Right. You wonder, how am I this stupid?
Right. Maybe I came on, I was like, wow, that shirt looks great.
I was like beating myself over the head. What was I thinking?
Yeah. Looked at the company. Sure enough, their about us says that they're in New York, right?
Yep. Yep.
And I get it. And it just smells like oil. I mean, it just smells so bad. And I'm like, I'm not wearing this. And I go to return it, and it's an email, right? And they're like, okay, well, you keep it. We'll give you 30% of your money.
Oh, I've had that happen too. I'm so pissed me off.
And then I'm sitting there negotiating with them, and they're like, all right, we'll give you 50%. And finally, I'm like, dude, I'm just going to report you. Like, I don't even know what to do. Or I'm just going to like do a chargeback on my credit card.
Right.
I do the chargeback on the credit card, and they're like, okay, fine. We'll give you 100% return. So it doesn't look like they have a
chargeback. You got to fight with them.
Chargeback, right? So I think like, The challenge is that we as consumers are used to being able to return stuff freely. That's one of the only ways that we buy things nowadays.
Yeah.
Which kind of sticks the brands with this, okay, I got to deal with the expense of this. Mm-hmm. I know there's going to be bad actors out there and I then have to operate on this thing. So how can I, what strategies can I deploy to try to keep as much of the money that this mm-hmm. customer has given me on hand, assuming they're never going to come back. I'm not trying mm-hmm. to keep this customer's business, right? And I think that it's a challenge, but again, like that's kind of where we come in when it's size related, right? I can't fix the materials. Mm-hmm. I can't fix the, mm-hmm. you know, whatever, but I can fix the, I don't know what size I am. I'm either going to buy two or three sizes and return two of them, keep the one that fits, or, you know, I'm going to buy the size that I normally buy in other brands and hope that that fits, or I'm going to abandon it and not buy anything together, right? Like we fix all of those problems, mm-hmm. and those mm-hmm. huge multi-billion dollar problems for the industry. So, you know, I think like companies, I guess, like we take a piece of what we can do, right? Mm-hmm. I can't solve the whole thing, but I can solve this piece of it and I can do it really well. And then we just have to evangelize that.
Do you get any pushback, you know, when you're out on the sales, out on the sales floor, so to speak, people saying, well, you know, if it doesn't, if the math is showing that it's just cheaper to let somebody keep something and refund them, then what's the impetus for them or what's the ROI for them to buy this technology?
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Like the ROI is so positively in our favor. I mean, mm-hmm. like we have been able to prove on hundreds of customers and millions of transactions now that for every dollar you pay Ware, you get $25 back.
Oh, well, that's a pretty good ROI. Here,
right? And it's like one of the highest ROI initiatives you could have on your site. Mm-hmm. And you don't have to do anything for it. It's the craziest thing in the world. Even with that, there's just complacency, or it's not the time yet, or this wasn't part of our roadmap yet, right? E-commerce is a really weird area because you get a lot of people that they're professionals, they've got mm-hmm. their strategies, they've got their, mm-hmm. you know, this is how I do what I do. And convincing them that they're wrong, or convincing them, maybe not that they're wrong, but there's just a different way is hard. It's really, really hard to do it. And it's, I think that's true for most businesses in life, but like you're convincing people to trust you, and building that trust is critical, you know, especially as a smaller company. Like you don't have the name recognition behind you. So you have to find different ways of building it, but it's challenging. Yeah.
Well, so there was something you said when we first talked that I wanted to dig into, and I'm forgetting what it is. So I'm going to go on to something else and hope that it comes back into my memory banks. Walk me through a day in your work week. What's that look like?
Which day?
pick any one you want.
Yeah, right.
Or sum up the whole week.
Yeah. So I kind of have these things that like I do every week, right? So it's just kind of like a punch card. Again, my sales and marketing job for Ware, right? I'm going to send out a marketing emailer based on what I see going on in the industry mm-hmm. every week, every 2 weeks, right? I'm going to communicate with people over LinkedIn at least every week. So I'm going to have at least one, mm-hmm. sometimes four or five posts on LinkedIn, right? To kind of like build this mindset. Mm-hmm. I am going to tune our marketing campaigns, like based on what I see. I'm going to look over the product. I'm going to get feedback from the product team and the customer success team and understand, are there changes that we can make to the product that prospects are asking for, that if we had this, we could close more deals, so on and so forth. And then I'm going to verify all of our operating numbers, right? So I'm going to look at like how many leads we got, how many impressions we got, how many support tickets we got, what's our average mm-hmm. resolution time. And I'm going to hold the team accountable to the goals that we set for them, right? So basically there's this split between management, which is it's my job to set goals for the team that I know are going to lead us to the KPIs that we care about. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I'm going to hold people accountable to that. They're going to self-report them and we're going to meet with them every week. Mm-hmm. And then there's the action items that I have to do and there's strategic items that I have to do. And then you got the same thing on Fit3D, right? There's uh-huh. the difference. Fit3D is like, I'm not physically doing any of the sales and marketing. I'm just talking to the team over there. Like, hey, here's what I see. This ad impacted me this way. Can you share with me the numbers on it? How are our leads doing? What if we tried this? We're not hitting this target. What can we do mm-hmm. differently? Right. So it's very much of a coach / strategic role on the Fit3D side, which I really love. Like, I think like that's where I excel. Mm-hmm. Because like my brain just fits that way really well on the contributor side. Like, I'll get to Friday and I'm like, oh, I forgot to send out the mailer this week. Like I have to do, you know, I have to make sure to get the one. Like, you know, it's my brand's much more of the coach than it is the contributor. So
I and you know, by the way, you are identifying the single biggest problem that founder CEOs have working in their business versus working on their business, which you just, you know, what you just said, but in different words, right? You know, you want to be the coach, the working on your business, and instead you're working in your business. And you know, eventually you will hopefully work your way out of that sales job that you're doing, right? As an individual contributor.
Yep.
Tell me a little bit about your life at work pre and post 2020.
Man, that's
And how you came back from that.
Yeah, it's rough. So pre 2020, I mean, like our hair was on fire. We were growing so fast, right? We doubled every year for 3 years straight. We were creeping up into eight figures. Mm-hmm. The business, we had only had Fit3D at the time, and we had developed this model that was really working really well. So we fundraised for this model. Basically what it was is at that time, with the Fit3D body scanner, you know, it was a $10,000 plus device. Mm-hmm. And then you would charge monthly service fees on top of that. And what we found is that most of our customers are like, look, can I just pay you for a long-term lease instead of buying this device? Can you be my financier? Mm-hmm. And we're like, okay, let's check into it. We raised some venture capital money. We launched that model and it was a massive success. Mm. And then COVID hit and all the liability that we now had in the industry turned into, you know, big goose eggs. These people are like, our business isn't open. We can't pay you. So we're not going to pay you. and because we're not a bank or whatever else, like we didn't have the collections
ability
to go after that money, and they wouldn't have them anyway. They would bankrupt the company. So we went from, you know, again, like very close to eight figures to zero in 1 month. Oh, and it was, I thought I was going to die. I mean, like,
it's got to be painful.
Like, oh my God, I, you know, support my family with this. You know, I have all these investors that I promised this was going to work. And, you know, as I got older, I realized like, you can't control that stuff.
No, investors, it's blind spots. You just don't, there's nothing you can,
right? So like, it's, you know, it is what it is. But we just found ways, right? And I think that this is, you know, I think my kids and my younger generation are just like, when this kind of stuff happens, they just think like, why are you still there? Why do you stick with it? And I'm like, I couldn't tell you that. I just have this thing in me that's like, I still believe that there's value here and I want to go get it and nothing's going to stop me. And that's just kind of how I live my life.
Yeah.
And so, you know, we found government programs, we found loans, we found grants, we found whatever we had to go through, downsizing, right? We had to go through strategic changes. We had to go through, I mean, everything you could possibly imagine to change around the business to get it to a self-sustaining state, we did. And it was just like one hurdle after the other, after the other, after the other. And, you know, now like 6 years later, we're finally in a spot where we have sustainable growth. We have a sustainable business, you know, but it was 6 years of, oh my God, am I going to eat next month? And that's hard. It's really, really, really challenging.
You know, I'll never forget when I was in my business pivot, my broker said to me, what's your plan B? And I said, don't have one.
Yeah, make plan A work.
Right. And, you know, I think what the, you know, as you point to the, you know, younger generation, which I'm assuming will be the Z's at this point, I'm not so sure they know the difference between want and commitment like you and I do, right? Like the boomers do, like the X's do. And I think there's millennials that get that as well. And there's probably Z's that do, but the, you know, the percentage changes as you kind of move down the food chain. And, you know, that's really the biggest distinction. A lot of people don't understand the difference between want and commitment. I mean, you know, commitment means going, going and going in the face of it's not working. Everybody's telling me, no, I'm not making any money, yada, yada, yada. But you know, that this is what companies need. It's just, you've got to figure out how to make it work. You know, maybe it's just it may be one little line in your sales pitch, right? Or, you know, as you're selling to somebody, just making one change in the outcome that they're going to see or whatever, rather than just saying, oh, this is too hard. I'm going to go find something else to do.
Yeah.
That's the want.
So I think it's really interesting because you're totally right. And I think there's something that gets missed in that, right? And a lot of times what I believe gets missed is do you still believe that your vision can be successful?
Right.
a lot of times, and a lot of the businesses that I mentor, these entrepreneurs will hold on to their business, but not be able to fundamentally agree or disagree that their business still has a chance,
right?
That the market still wants their product or their service, their whatever else, right? So I think there's all these leading indicators that you can look at to validate whether or not what you're doing has a chance to be successful. Mm-hmm. If the answer to that question is no, then I totally understand jumping ship, right? I mean, do it with grace. You know, the people that supported you, like, man, thank him, you know, but move on. Give them an opportunity for your next venture, you know, be super honest and transparent with them, but don't keep kicking a can down the road that has no possibility of turning
right.
into
something. Well, herein lies the distinction, right? I mean, it's one thing to be committed to something. It's another thing to really realize, you know, I am just barking up the wrong tree.
Right.
It's not that I'm not committed to what I'm doing. It's that I think I've chosen the wrong way to go, or people don't really need, there's not a need for my product. You know, because I have something to say about this, how did you come around to this is something that I want to do that companies really need?
Yeah. So, you know, pre-COVID, when we very first started, I'll never forget, I closed my first deal and we didn't have a bank account or a product yet. Right. So
yeah, right.
I was selling this allure of a product that did this.
Vaporware.
With vaporware, right? And I was just like, look, if I can convince somebody to sell something that I don't have, but I know that I can build,
yeah,
and they're willing to pay me for it, and I know that I'm going to give them their money back if I can't do this, mm-hmm. and I'm going to give myself enough time. I was like, hey, here's what we're doing. Here's where it is. Here's what it should do when it gets there. I think we're 6 months away. If you want to buy this thing now, I'll give you a discount, get your money in the bank. And if we don't produce it, I'll give it back, right? And they were just like, thank you for your transparency. I love what you're doing. We need it. We're in. And that was a really interesting moment for me, because at that time, my wife at the time had just told me we were pregnant, right? And I had like a pretty cushy job working in Major League Baseball. And I was just like, yeah, you know what? I'm going to quit it. I'm going to go bet on me. We're going to go. And I just was like, what the heck are you doing? I was like, look, I just have this feeling. I got to do it. But those proof points, again, like, is there demand for what you want? Right. And then you can turn that fast forward to COVID. In COVID, it was the same thing, right? Even though we had this like business that went just crumbled, right? Went to zero from a revenue perspective. Our customers were still reaching out to us saying like, hey, can I get a discount on the service? I think I'm going to open my business. I'm going to do it clandestine. I'm not going to advertise it. And I'm going to let people use the device, but can you turn it back on? And I pay you a discounted rate. And I was like, okay, cool. There's still demand. They want to use this machine because it's going to provide them value. And then as we got a little bit further down the road, then we still have orders come through. We couldn't fulfill them because our supply chain was just broken.
Right.
Right. I mean, you could ship stuff, you could get stuff from anywhere, you can get plastics or materials or metals, whatever. But there, and I was like, look, we'll sell it to you. You have to prepay for it. And we're thinking 6 to 8 months. I don't know if we can get it before that.
Wow.
You're like, sure. Are you willing to take a deposit? And so, again, you look at the leading indicators and demand is a really, really, really strong indicator of your business's value. Right. If you cannot generate demand, you will not have a business.
Right.
Right. You could supply the best widget, pet rock, whatever you want, but if nobody wants it, your business, that leading indicator of desire and demand will tell you how your business can possibly move forward, whether or not it should move forward if there's success. And you know, again, I think that demand side is something we all believe in what we're selling.
Yeah.
But does the market believe in what you're selling? And those are two very different things.
Yes, they are.
And I think you need to understand, does the market believe in what you're selling in order to push through all the cruft that you're going to have to push through in order to run a business successfully?
How'd the idea come to you?
Yeah, I was, again, I was working for, so my background is, if you watch like baseball on TV at all, as part of the inventing team that invented the pitch tracking technology. So it's basically like predicting where a pitch is released out of the pitcher's hand, where it's going to cross plate, speed, launch angle, whatever. And so I had a lot of like understanding of like really heavy physics modeling, data modeling, computer vision, stuff like that. I was, I don't know, 8 years into that business. And I was like, okay, like I've done what I can do here. You know, I'm kind of looking for the next thing. And my mom was actually going through a weight loss program for my sister's wedding at the time. and she had tried like weight loss programs forever. But nothing really resonated, right? It was always like quick diets or quick hitters. Yeah. And this time she got a trainer, she got a nutritionist, and I'd go home and visit her every couple months, you know, and her body was like fitting inside of itself. It was like those little Russian dolls.
I love it.
And she got to a point where her weight stopped going down, just kind of plateaued, but her body just kept
Which is not uncommon, right?
And finally, she ended up quitting her program. She's like, it's not working. My weight's not going down anymore. I was like, what do you mean? Like, you're so healthy. Like, you're running around. Like, I don't understand it. And it dawned on me that there was no solution in the commercial wellness industry that was able to track the entirety of body changes, which, again, my thesis was that people motivated to their program longer.
Mm-hmm.
That was the first step. But then I was like, the market's not big enough. I couldn't raise venture money for it. Like, you know, it's a cool product, but I don't know that it's going to like move things, right? And so then I started thinking about it more, and this is where the data play came to me. And I was like, wait, I'm capturing a data set that doesn't exist. And so could I choose a market that I can go to where I can deploy this technology? They can then use the technology to sign new members, keep members longer, help the members achieve goals better, but they're fragmented enough that I could own the data and I could do things with the data, right? Obviously adhering to HIPAA and privacy policies and everything else, but could I use the data to do other stuff with it? And when we found commercial wellness, we're like, okay, this is a hyper fragmented industry. Almost everything in it is SMB. So I can do my plan, right? I can go in, offer the service, help their businesses, keep the data, build other businesses on top of it or other products or solutions. And so that's when, for me, it became like a kind of a no-brainer. It was like, yeah, I have to do this. I think this is a multi-billion dollar opportunity. It's going to be really hard, but I think we can do it. And that thought has never left me, right? To this day, I'm like, yeah, this opportunity is still huge. And it's going to be solved. And I want to be the one to solve it.
So couple more questions. What would you say is your biggest bottleneck to growth right now, Greg?
Money, capital. So, which is kind of like, okay, it is for every business, right? But like, I think that on the Fit3D side, like we have a good growth engine. We know exactly what to do to grow. It's scaling by, 40 to 50 new customers every single month. And if I can ingest more cash into the growth engine, into advertising, marketing, and sales, I know that we could probably double, maybe even triple that. I know there's enough money for it. The challenge, why don't we get that cash, right?
And I think that's my next question, of course.
That's the next question always. We raised venture money in 2017, right? So our cap table is like 50-50 split between venture and common, right? The founders of common stock. And then we raised a bunch of debt, which we're now paying back, right? So now all of the cash proceeds are going to debt payback through that period between COVID to now. And because we have this cap table that already has a round in it, right? Any new capital coming in would either have to down round that, which those investors are not very happy about,
right?
Or they'd have to take a huge chunk of common at probably a devalued state.
Well, yeah. I mean, you know, nobody likes a, 3-to-1 split or, or 3-to-5 or whatever it is. Nobody likes their shares being dissolved, diluted.
So, so the bet that we're making is that what we're trying to do here is have the company continue to pay off debt until it's like a very serviceable opportunity. We're really close to. Then grow the company to like an ARR of north of 3 mil on each side, right? Which again, we're getting really close to. At that point, I can pitch a valuation that's high enough that I don't have to take a down round. And I think there's enough opportunity to scale it forward. So we're making this like financially engineered bet that we can achieve these things on the capital we have. And if we can, then it's going to work out really, really well. If we don't, then it's my job to then renegotiate the deals that I already have on the table, right? Which is really at the end of the day, like the CEO's job is to make sure you have direction and money. So you know, that's my job. And so I have to do those things if stuff fails. And okay, I've done it before, fine, I'll figure it out. But I'd really like to hit the targets that we have, and we are hitting them, which is really cool. So if it works out the way we anticipate it, then we're in a really, really, really good position in like 12 to 18 months. And so that's what we're shooting for.
Outstanding.
So limits growth a little bit, but it's profitable organic growth. It shows the industry wants us. There's a lot of really good things out of it. So we're leaning into it.
Outstanding. Is there anything that we haven't talked about that I neglected to ask that, you know, anything that you want to talk about before we go?
Sure.
Am I sure? No, I don't know. Let's see what you say.
Yeah. I think like, you know, as a, given that this is a podcast for entrepreneurs. Again, I think the biggest thing is like, understand that, excuse my language, but shit's going to happen. It's not going to be pretty all the time. You know, you go into it thinking it is.
No.
And that's where like choosing something you're really, really passionate about really matters because you need something that wakes you up in the morning, maybe even wakes you up at night when you have a fleeting idea and you need to get it down on paper. And when you feel that level of passion, you have step one, and step two is validating demand. And if you have passion and demand, you can have a business. All you have to do is kind of just not mess up. Get people around you that understand what you're doing. They can help. And I think you have something really, really powerful. So look at the passion and demand. And I think those two things, like, they're going to make for a really successful opportunity.
Yeah, very, very good. Okay, well, Greg Moore, founder and CEO of Fit3D and its umbrella of Fit3D and Wear. Thanks for being with me. This is an interesting conversation. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me on, Carol.
Thanks for listening to Evolving Your Workplace. Is there a topic you want to discuss? Let us know what you think in a review. And don't forget to click follow to stay up to date on upcoming episodes. Thanks again for listening, and see you next time.